Hi, everybody. I'm Tony Malarick, and I'm a persistently procrastinating but ever so grateful Al-Anon member. And by the mercy of God, the help of the program, you Al-Anoners and AAers, I've not found it necessary to plan a murder or to contemplate suicide since October 1970. And I already need a drink. Well, let's see. I'd like to take this moment, now that I'm already lost, to thank the committee for allowing me to have the privilege of being with you this morning. Marge and Phil and Sue and Jean and John and Dick and seven George and 79 others that have just been marvelous. And then you people. And you know, there's a force, a feeling when you get amongst you people. It's really something. It's that goodness, the love, the caring, the sharing that just permeates the air. And you know, you get it in quiet times. You can just feel the love that you've received and the special circumstances that come when you're in, especially in a circumstance like this, when you're at a roundup. Or sometimes it's in great sound, like I happen to be at Seattle, and when the Parade of Nations came in, and there were 38 nations, and they came in, and my gosh, we just gave them applause, and through the whole time that they marched in, there was just really a great deal of applause, and this feeling, this force was there, and all of a sudden, there was great, great applause because the Russians came. And to think that that the originators of the Iron Curtain, you know, just that group who don't believe that there is such a thing as a higher power, they were there, and there were about 20 of them that were coming through. And, of course, the applause just increased about 30 decibels. And they just beamed, you know, and they just strutting their stuff as they went around there. And it was just marvelous. I was sitting next to a couple from New Zealand. And this fellow gave me a little bit of his story, how he got into AA. And he said he was just here from over the crick. And yesterday, I was reading my One Day at a Time and trying to figure out what the heck I should say this morning. As I say, I procrastinate a little bit. And I came upon this, and I can't do better than read from this. So if you don't mind, I'll just give you today's reminder. I'm sure you Al-Anoners read this, but maybe some of you didn't, and AAers would like to hear this. As I talk with my hometown friends in Al-Anon, I realize that we are all part of something much bigger than our single group. I will remember and send loving thoughts to those in our thousands of groups around the world. This exchange will enrich all of us. And then the quote, "This is truly a movement of the Spirit, and I firmly believe that the unity of the world in understanding and peace could come from these efforts." And it's signed, a member in New Zealand. And that's true. It works. Well, before I get into my eulogy on Al-Anon, I'd really like to talk to you AAers. And, you know, 7 years before I ever knew there was such a thing as Al-Anon, you AAers gave me the support, kept me sane, saner, until I could walk through the doors of Al-Anon. And I really recognize a deep debt of gratitude, and I will always remember that and try to repay in kind. There is one AAer I'd like to single out, and she was my greatest teacher and my most aggravating adversary. She took me to the pits of despair and the pinnacles of joy. She was my greatest blessing, my greatest problem. And not only did she do the damnedest things in order to get me the right to get into Al-Anon, but besides that, she so brainwashed me that I even had to question the sanity of my own principles. But beyond that, she taught me how to love. She taught me how to love not just the lovable, because anybody can do that, but she taught me how to love the unlovable. And certainly, there's no one more unlovable than a full-blown practicing alcoholic. And at this time, I would like to introduce her to you, but she isn't here today. She's ill, and I guarantee she's ill enough so if she were half well, she'd be here. She really loves to be with you. Well, at any rate, the big book says that we are supposed to tell what we were like then and what happened, what we're like now. Not what it was like, but what we were like. And, you know, unfortunately, the description that sticks in my craw is a description given by Dan Anderson. He's the past director of Hazleton Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center at Center City, Minnesota. And it was on the occasion of Helen's second vacation at Hazleton. And he said this to her. He said, "Helen, you know that Tony is a pompous, self-righteous horse's ass." And, of course, he was wrong. But, he didn't complete it at any rate. But I really don't want to argue about that. What I would like to do, though, is try to give you a little idea of why somebody might describe me this way. And my thoughts go back to when I was a little kid in Caledonia, Minnesota, and I was sitting on the back stoop of our house and with my arm around my dog, and I felt sad and left out and unwanted, and I didn't seem to have but a rare friend, and I didn't know how to make friends my own age, and I didn't know where I belonged. And it might have been because at the age of 4, I was put into an orphanage for a few months. And at the age of 5, I was at this temporary boarding school for a few months. And then at 6 and 7, away at school, at boarding school, nice one though, for a couple years. And I always felt that I was the new man on the block, the new kid on the block, and I needed friends, and I just had a hard time making friends my own age. I could do real well with the adults because I'd been given a set of principles or rules by my folks. They told me that I had to be a good kid, and I had to do my best, and of course that meant that anything worth doing was worth doing well. And then also that I should obey my parents and anybody they put in charge of me. Well, being a good kid, or I mean a normal kid, I guess, because I had to test these rules. And of course, when I did things my own way, well, I either got it in the end or else they ignored me. And I didn't like either one. And when I did things the right way or their way, Why, by gosh, my mother was real nice to me, and she'd give me a hug, or she'd pat me on the head, or my dad, even when he was there, at least he wouldn't scowl at me. And so I had to use, this is what I had to use, and so being in dire need of friends, and only knowing this, and thinking that I had to prove myself, well, I did the only thing I knew how to do, and that was work hard and obey my elders. Well, I did so well that by the time I'd gotten through my second year, they decided that I should skip the third year. And you know, the principle behind all this is, what we live with, we learn. What we learn, we practice. What we practice, we become. And what we become has consequences. And that's how it works. And I had another principle that I lived with at that particular time, and that was that I lived in a vale of tears, that the good die young, that I had to go through this life, this vale of tears, in order to gain my reward at the end, heaven at the end of this life. And those were the two things that sort of permeated my direction and my activities in that, and through most of my life, actually. And those are hard things. And of course, as I said, being away from home a great deal, and with those kind of principles, why I was in trouble. And so I really had to work hard at this thing to prove that I had some worth to have friendships. And as you get up in the ladder of education, you know, things get harder to accomplish, to show my worth. And so I had to be more defensive. I couldn't let people get too close to me. They might find out how crummy I was. I had to be a perfectionist, of course. And then I had to be a people pleaser, because, of course, that was so terribly important to me. But then I was married. Now, I didn't know at that time, nor did Helen know, that she was alcoholic. She was, of course, I realized she drank differently. That is, she drank potent drinks from large containers. And, of course, she was from the big city of St. Paul, and I was from the little town of Caledonia. And, of course, I thought that, you know, certainly I was a guy that was out of step. Because certainly all her friends, my gosh, they drank heavily and they partied frequently. And that word frequently reminds me of the second thing that was so common, at least in our early marriage, and that was arguments. Now, you may not know that there's a difference between engagement and marriage, but there is. And things so compatible before our marriage became a complete misfit of purpose and direction just hours later. I mean the same day. And, this erratic behavior really had me confused. Well, as a matter of fact, that reminds me, I can give you my whole talk in 5 words. Listen carefully. First is confusion, then we advance to chaos, and then to crisis, and then recovery, and finally spiritual. That's it, folks. And whoever decides to stay from here on, you're properly warned. I do have a few things to fill in, though, so I thought they'd give me a few more minutes. And, you know, so we're up to the aspect of what happened. Well, you know, what happened to me, I don't think was a heck of a lot different than I've heard from many and many of you. For instance, we had psychiatrists in our lives. And maybe some of you or your spouse had psychiatrists. Well, as a matter of fact, we were so fouled up that by the time we'd been married only 9 months, Helen was seeing her first psychiatrist. Now, this was the first of 11 that, as she said, she interviewed during during the active part of this disease. Well, and then there's loneliness. I've heard that happens, and it sure happened to me, and I found this the most devastating emotion that I had to deal with during this particular process. You know, I had mentioned that I felt left out, unwanted. I didn't know where I belonged. Well, when the idea of marriage came along, well, I thought, my gosh, here's the answer. I'm going to belong to this family, you know. And by gosh, I'm going to see that I communicate. I'm going to confide everything in this gal. And then there's just not going to be any question about our relationship. And so when I'd come home at night and I'd tell all my secrets, even the bad things that had happened, and I sure don't like to talk about those, why, never could she come in kind. And I wondered, now why doesn't she trust me? And so a wedge was driven between us, and that darn thing got wider and wider, and so I was alone again. And I had to wonder, you know, what's going on? Why can't she trust me? And I had to look beyond that for someone to relate to. And of course I had my God, and I prayed, and he was great, and he did comfort me a great deal. And I prayed for 5 years and 10 and 15 years, and I wondered why he hadn't gotten the message. But I knew that his ways, at least they say his ways, are not my ways, and I believed that. And so I kept praying, but when towards the end, when things got so critical, I had to wonder, have you abandoned me also? And that's a lonely place to be. Well, then there's, one thing that probably never happened to you Al-Anoners, looking for the bottle or finding the bottle. But at any rate, it happened to me, and it went this way. One night, I thought I had a heartburn or an ulcer, you know, and I had brought some samples of Jellicle or an antacid home, and I went looking for them, found them under the sink in the bathroom, took out a bottle and shook it up, you know, and took off the cap and took a swig and pooey. It was Jellicle colored vodka. And of course I got a little upshook, and I thought, God darn her. I'm going to find out where she has the rest of this stuff stashed away. And so I snuck around all night and trying to find out where she had the other stuff, you know. And I learned one lesson. You know, you can't stay up all night without getting tired the next day. But you know, I was a good Al-Anoner, a potential Al-Anoner. I want you to know that. Because I knew what her problems were, and I sure as heck told her, and I was right. And I remember when she went back to Hazleton the second time, I went up there, and of course I had certain responsibilities, and I had to find out why she slipped. And so I had heard about this fellow Lynn Carroll. He was reputed to be a very good counselor. And so I asked Lynn, I said, well, how do you know when they're going to slip? And Lynn says, well, Tony, you don't. He said, you don't know when they're going to slip, but I can tell you this. If they miss a meeting, why, be careful. And if they miss two, they're probably thinking about it. And if three, they're probably already in the sauce. And so I went home, and of course I had been warned, and so I was good. I kept a careful vigil, and sure enough, came the time she missed one. Well, I encouraged her throughout the week, and I instructed her in how valuable this program was, and came the night of the meeting. And I talked about it frequently during the meal, and then about towards the end of the meal, she got up and went to the bathroom, and And I waited and waited and waited and waited. And I went to the bathroom, knocked on the door, and I said, gosh, I said, we better go. I said, if we don't go right now, we're going to be late. And she says, I'm not going. I said, oh, you got to go. Well, she said, I'm not going. And so I tried the knob, and of course it was locked. And, well, I can tell you, I didn't let her go to the bathroom the next week. And came the end of the meal, and of course I said, well, it's time to go to your meeting. And she said, I'm not going. And I said, oh, yes, you are. Well, she said, no. And I said, oh, yes, you are. And I picked her up bodily, and I put her in the car, and we drove off to the meeting. And we got down to Highway 13 and 55 at a stop sign, and I stopped, and guess what? She opened the door and walked off into the night. Well, you know, well, I got all over the edge of the road and went down 13, and our parish was, a church was right there, and I thought she'd probably be wandering around those buildings. And so I went around looking for her, and it was a cold, sleety, wet, rainy night, and God darn it, you know, I couldn't find her. And after about an hour, I went into one of the doorways, and I thought, my gosh, what am I going to do? Here she is, you know, we're miles from home, and how is she going to get home if I do find her? And cripes, I've already been looking for over an hour, and I can't find her, and what a mess, you know. And then there was a voice from the darkness, and it said, I think the meeting's over, and so we might as well go home. Oh, my gosh, I tell you, I really could have blown a fuse. And, well, I learned something from that. I learned if you're going to take somebody to a meeting against their will, you better have two of you. Well, you know, I really didn't learn it. Yeah, it took years before I learned that I didn't have control. I was powerless. Well, you know, there's other things such as, treatment. Yeah, that's a thing that's probably happened to many of you. Now, in our case, Helen went to treatment 6 times, and 5 times at Hazleton, and 1 at Hastings State Hospital A&D unit. Now, each time she'd go up there for 4 or 5 weeks, she'd get all that care and relaxation. And they gave me an hour, you know, when I'd come up there. Of course, I wasn't very sick, and so I didn't need it. But I'd get an hour with one of the counselors, and by the time she'd gotten to the 5th time up there, I had worked myself all the way up to the chief counselor. And Dick says to me, he said, Tony, have you ever thought of Al-Anon? And I said, Al-a-who? And he said, oh, it's a program for the friends and family of the alcoholic. And I said, no. I said, well, where are they? How do you find them? He said, well, just look them up in the telephone book. He said, and go to a meeting. And with that very dynamic, forceful recommendation, you know, I rushed right out of there and went home. About 5 months later, I ambled over to my first meeting, and as a matter of fact, it looked like a nice group. And then they said I was in AA and I should go upstairs. And of course, on the 3rd floor in the back room, in a small room with a card table and 2 chairs, was the meeting. And a couple of gals there, and I don't remember a word they said, but one was doing this and one was doing that, and I guess they're knitting and tatting, and I thought these were prerequisites for belonging to Al-Anon, and I really didn't know whether I wanted to learn them, and so I didn't rush off to my next meeting. And you know, but when your higher power decides that you're going to do something, well, watch out. And I don't know why he singled me out for the opportunity of getting into the program, but he did. And he favored me with that. And you know, there are a lot of good people that never get that chance. And he picked me out. And I was so blessed, and I am so blessed to have the chance. Well, guess what he did? All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, Ernie calls me. Well, I didn't know Ernie from Adam. And he says, I hear you've got a problem. And what the heck are you talking about, you know? And I keep things pretty quiet, you know. Well, he said, I hear you have a problem. He said, my wife's an alcoholic. And he said, I thought maybe we could have lunch together. And I thought, well, gosh, maybe he's got the hot poop. And he know just exactly, just how to fix this gal. And so I said, well, it just happens. This is Wednesday. I've got the afternoon off. I was about to have lunch. Why don't you come over? And he said, sure. So he got over there. And guess what? He was just going to get me to a meeting. And, well, at any rate, he coerced me. And I guess he thought he needed some help. And he and Ed got there Monday night. And it was he took me to an all-men's group. Well, of course, that was different. And but there were about 17 of them. There was a guy who was leading the meeting, and he started out, and he turned to me, and he said, Tony, do you have any questions? I said, I better listen. And so they went around. Each one had something to say, you know. And then he got back to him, and he looked over at me, and he said, well, Tony, have you got any questions now? I said, well, no. You know, I'm sort of a quiet guy. I don't like to rock the boat. I don't like to make waves. So I said, no. And he said, well, is there anything you'd like to say? And I don't know what got into me, but I guess they got a burr under my saddle or something like that. And so I said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. I said, if this is Al-Anon, there's nothing here for me. And my gosh, I said, I've listened to you, and not a one of you knows what a problem is. I said, I ought to tell you what a problem is. And so I decided, now's the time, and I gave it to him. And I gave it to him with both shoulders. And my gosh, what do you know? After a while, I noticed they were nodding, and they were smiling at me. And I thought, my gosh, what a kooky group this is. I'm telling them their outfit's no good, and they're smiling at me, you know. So I quieted down a little bit, and I heard myself ranting and raving there, and I thought I better shut up, you know. And I stopped, and I looked for the closest exit, you know. And then the craziest thing happened. I felt so light. You know, I just really felt good. I hadn't felt that good in years, you know. And I guess I had gotten rid of about 37 tons of garbage, you know. And so I had to eat humble pie, and I admitted I felt awfully good, you know. And so they were real nice. They even invited me back. Well, you know, things were happening too fast. By this time, things got really awfully serious about this time, and I really didn't get into the program enough to know how to use it. However, about this time, Helen made a real valiant attempt at suicide, and she almost accomplished this, and she was in intensive care for 4 days and nights, and they told us that we should not expect her to live. She did live, though, and then they put her up on the psych floor, and she was introduced to her 11th full-service psychiatrist. And eventually she got home. And then it wasn't too long. It was about 6 months later, so I guess she... she says she heard me talking to George Mann. And George is a director of St. Mary's Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center. And I had talked to him, but I don't know what I was talking to him about. And but I actually was talking about myself, and she thought I was getting ready to get her into treatment again. And so the next day she went out to pick up the kids, and it was raining, and they have to, the bus drops them off a fair distance from the house. And she went down to pick them up, and she had Tony Maria, our three-year-old, with her, and she greeted them with, "I'm going on a vacation, and who wants to come?" And Leah says, "Well, I'll go with you," and she's our eldest. And Danette says, "Well, I better stay with Dad." And Helen says, "Okay, suit yourself." And she says, "Get out." And Helen had to walk home in the rain. But at any rate, and then they disappeared. And they disappeared for 4 days. And she had threatened to take her life and the life of the kids. And not too long before that, a mutual friend, a friend of ours, had put herself in the car with her two girls and turned on the gas and closed the garage doors and had died. And she'd threatened to do the same thing with our kids. Well, now here she was gone, and I tell you, that was a very concerned 4 days for us. And of course, I called the police, and then of all the things, they suggested that I was the cause of this, and that they asked me what I had done to drive her from the house, and they wouldn't do anything about it. They said probably she just wanted to get rid or away from me. And well, at any rate, 4 days later, I got this call, and I thought she was calling from long distance, and she said, "Well, if I agree to come home, will you promise not to put me in treatment?" Well, what a question. Well, I started thinking awfully fast, and I don't know why, but I finally said to her, "Well," I said, "you're sick. You really deserve the best. You deserve treatment. And no, I can't make that promise." Yeah, at any rate, that's what I said. And she, whack, down went the phone. Well, she was at the airport, as a matter of fact. And so she got in her car, and she drove to the end of the driveway and dropped the kids off. And she had called her full-service psychiatrist and said, "I'm sick, and would you put me into the psych floor?" And he says, "Sure, go on down, put yourself in, and I'll be down later to check you in." And so she was down there, and when she was down there, I went down and I suggested that she go to treatment, and I suggested Kincannon's program at Ramsey. And she said, "Well, I don't like Kincannon. I've never liked him, and I don't like him now, and I'm not going." Well, I had to have a court hearing then, of course, and of course that upshook me, and I didn't know just what was going to happen. And as I said, I didn't really know the program well, and the only thing I could sort of look at that I could understand was the second part of the Serenity Prayer, the courage to change the things that I can. And so I tried to do everything I could. I wanted her to get this help, and so I thought I should go all out to make this one last effort. And so I had 40 people there. I had my in-laws and my outlaws, and there was my lawyer and myself, and there was Helen and her lawyer. But you know, those alcoholics, they are clever, and they're cunning, and they're con artists. And Helen takes a back seat to no one, I assure you. And I knew she had an ace up her sleeve, and sure enough, after a little bit, long came her psychiatrist. And he says, "Oh yes, Helen is sick, but she doesn't need alcohol and drug treatment. All she needs is my good psychiatric help." You know, this after having been treating her for over 6 months, and then her absconding with the kids and herself, and just that's all she needed. Well, at any rate, she was committed, and I was exhausted. And she was committed to Hastings State Hospital Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center, And I thought that she was committed there for a long term rather than just the usual 4 weeks. Well, at any rate, so I went back home. And I went back to work and tried to get the family, the kids back into the usual slots. And about 4 weeks later, I came home, and guess what? There was Helen. And she was angry, and she was spiteful and resentful. And she says, "You don't have to worry about my drinking." She said, "My lawyer told me that all I have to do is stay sober for 3 months, and I can sue you for divorce, and I can get the kids, and then I will live as I darn well please." My gosh. For 17 years, I'd been trying to get this gal free of these drugs, liquid and solid. And for 17 years, I had failed. And now, I had failed again. My greatest effort, and I had failed again. Well, I didn't know what to do. You know, I was numb, and I ran out of that house, and I ran across the fields, and finally I sat down and I cried. And I thought of my friends, and I knew they couldn't help me. I had already tried, and they couldn't help me. And then I thought of God, and I thought He had abandoned me. And I despaired. And I thought of suicide. And then it was like I was in a deep, dark pit. And it was black and silence. And then I knew all of a sudden that somebody was there. And it was God. And I guess I had a little humility, because just like that, whether you believe it or not, just like that, a warmth came over to me, like from cell to cell over my whole body. I was at peace. This terrible life of turmoil and chaos was behind me. I had a new life. I was free. I had peace. I had serenity. And it isn't like I have had that always, but that was the beginning then. And from there, I started working the program. And it's that part, this recovery part, that I'd really like to say a few words. I'd like to talk a little bit about part of my journey into this recovery program. Now, when I first got in here, I saw that you people had something I wanted. I saw an inner peace that you people had, and I wanted that. And I really wanted peace. And then, you, of course, you always had a twinkle in your eye, and you're always smiling and even laughing. And I couldn't figure out why the heck you were laughing. I thought this thing was too serious for laughter. But I must admit that I hadn't laughed for a long, many years. But at any rate, I put up with that. But I wanted this peace. And so I asked you, what do I do to get it? And you said, you work the program. I said, okay, how do you work the program? And I don't know. Right then, there was an impasse of communication. I don't know, whatever. I must have been talking in Yiddish or something, and because you never did seem to understand what I was asking you, because you never gave me an answer. And you'd say, oh, something like, well, don't worry, it takes time. And I said, well, how do you work this program? You know, I had to get this piece, and I needed it now, you know. And then somebody'd say, well, read the literature. Well, God darn, I got every book. I got every God darn book and every pamphlet, and I read them, and I read them right away. And it was great, you know, this one day at a time, I'd get at that, and I'd read that day, and of course I'd read 10 days ahead and 5 days back, and boy, you know, about 30 things I had to work on that day. Well, you know, I was spaghetti. And after a while, I realized, you know, I wasn't getting any place. You know, I was just all mixed up. And I had to have this peace. And so I knew I had to stop and look at this thing and get onto one thing, and I had to start working that, and then I could do something. And so I looked at the program, and God darn it, I couldn't figure out anything. But finally I realized, I thought I understood one slogan, and that slogan was one day at a time. And I thought, before I ever got in this program, I had been working on that. You know, I knew I'd been cross-eyed. That is, I had one eye on yesterday and one eye on tomorrow, and I couldn't see anything on today. And, you know, I was always thinking of the guilt of what I hadn't accomplished yesterday, and then I'd think of the fabulous things I was going to do in the future, and, of course, there wasn't any time for the present. So I sort of knew what I was supposed to do, and I thought, doggone, this is it. But it was slow. My gosh, in 5 minutes I'd be back thinking about what I should be doing to fix Helen, to manage her situation, and then so I'd have to drag myself back and get on track again, and it was awfully slow. So after a couple of weeks, I'd only had, I could possibly put a half an hour together. But even that was an improvement, you know, and so I could understand that. And, of course, I went on to a few other defects that I dragged up. I found that I did have. And, there was self-pity and procrastination and self-righteous and self-centeredness and, well, a few others. And I liked that self-pity stuff, you know. And I liked to wallow in that warm ooze. And fortunately, I didn't get caught and swallowed up by that quicksand before I realized what was going on. But at any rate, finally, I did catch, got an insight, and it was into prayer. Now, I had realized that there must be something wrong with my praying, because I had prayed 17 years, and I hadn't gotten one thing that, of course, that I'd asked for, and I certainly knew that God should see to it that she stopped using this stuff, and he hadn't heard me. Well, I thought, now I've got to learn how to pray. And finally the light went on in that 11th step, and it, of course, the second part of the 11th step says, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. My gosh, that's exactly how we're supposed to pray, isn't it? Praying only. That's the only way to pray for knowledge of his will for us. My gosh, that's it. Well, I had to put it into my language so I could sort of understand it a little better or use it. And so I finally got to the idea of asking for his guidance. And I could make it to the bathroom on my own in the morning, but after that I'd have enough cells knocking around in there so that I'd realize I better quickly ask for his guidance. And so I'd ask him to please give me his guidance. Direct me and show me what I should do. And I'd roll up my sleeves, and by gosh, the two of us were great. We accomplished things right like that. I mean, right away. And things were marvelous. They were marvelously better. Of course, being a good Al-Anoner, I knew that things were going to fall apart pretty soon. And so I, naturally, there were days when things got all goofed up. And by afternoon, things were so bad that I realized that I was on the wrong track. And so I'd have to say, well, God, now what's going on? And I'd learned by this time to, first of all, ask what I was doing. So I'd say, well, God, I said, what am I doing wrong now? And he said, well, Tony, he said, you didn't ask me to take over today and give you, and show you what way to go. He said, you've been managing all day. Well, of course, I'd been managing it. And, of course, things were so fouled up. And even if it were late in the day, and I remember like one Monday I was on the late shift and begin at 2 and we'd go to 10 or something like that. And here it was 7:30 and I was really working well. I was only half an hour late. And I had a number of patients to see. And guess what? A little gal came in, 12 years old, and she had ripped her elbow open. And so I went back there to see it. I had to stop my appointed patients, and I went back there to see her. And I had to anesthetize the elbow in order to take a look at it. And it was a mess, and I knew it by the time I looked at it, it was going to take at least an hour and a half or maybe two. And here, I'd be 2 hours late, and I had all these people waiting for me. And I said, well, okay, God. I said, I'm in this mess, and I didn't ask for this, you know. So you're going to have to take over and show me what to do. And then, so I turned it over, and by gosh, I told my nurse, I said, well, you better go out and tell the people what's going on. And I tell them I'll see all of them if anybody wants to wait, but, you know, it's going to be a long time. Well, by gosh, I you know, all that gave me ease, and I could pay attention to what I was doing. I got in there, and I was done by about an hour and 15 minutes. And I went out there, and they all stayed. But that was okay, because now every darn one of them that came in apologized for waiting. And usually, of course, what I'd have to do is I'd have to apologize to them for making them wait. And so it was really nice. And we got through the whole night, and I was happy, and I guess they were happy. And that's what your higher power can do for you. Well, you know, however, you know, I had to realize that there were many days when there just wasn't any sunshine. And one weekend I was on call, however, and one of my partners said that he had a young terminally ill cancer patient, and he told me about him. And I went in to see him the next morning, on Saturday morning, and I wasn't ready at all for what I saw. Because there, laying on the bed, was this fellow with this this skin pulled taut across his face, and these two black holes, and this black head of hair on, and he looked like a skull with a wig on, a black wig on it. And my gosh, my mouth fell open, you know, fortunately I couldn't speak, because the fellow came up with something else, and I wasn't ready for that. And he says, "Doctor," he says, "you got to help me live." Well, my gosh, this guy couldn't even pull his head off the pillow. He was really terminal, and I didn't have an answer for that. And thank heaven, my mouth was still open, and I didn't have anything to say. And then he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, doctor." He said, "I know you doctors told me that I have to eat." And he says, "I can get one spoonful down," but he said that second one, he said, it goes down and then up and down and up. And he says, "I gag and gag and gag and gag." And he said, "I just can't get it down." He said, "But I will." He said, "I will." And I know I got out of there, but I couldn't get that guy out of my mind. Because I realized that there was a remarkable contradiction here. He was giving every last moment, every last bit of strength for one day. And I knew that I would pass up a couple days just to get to a good day. And, you know, in this psalm, "This is the day the Lord hath made. Rejoice and be glad." Well, crumb, I knew right in my guts that there were many Mondays. As a matter of fact, most of them, I would fear those Mondays. And how did you reconcile these things? But then, a few weeks later, I heard a tape. And this was by Ernie Larson. And of all things, it was on projection. Well, As I told you, I had gone and I had considered all kinds of things, but one thing I had never thought I had a problem with was projection. But sure enough, this thing hit me right between the ears. For didn't I say, if only I can get past Monday, it's going to be downhill to Wednesday, and then I'll have some time and I can make rounds and do my charts and go to the nursing homes, and then I'll still have time to jog or have some relaxation, or wait till the weekend. Boy, then I'm going to be able to put my feet up, or after I take care of the lawn and fix the fence and paint the barn and a few other things that Helen has for me. And or when I get this deck done, boy, the whole family's going to have a great time and a picnic here, and we're just going to have a wee of a time. Or boy, wait till I retire. Then I'm going to start living. Now, what did you say? I said, wait till I retire. Then I'm going to start living. And all of a sudden, the light went on. My gosh, how stupid can you get? Here you're waiting till you're in a wheelchair before you were going to start living, huh? And you know, even I could understand that was senseless. And so then I realized, you know, this moment is the only moment I have. I've got to do the very best with this moment right now. And if I give everything I've got right at this moment, and also each moment during this day, by gosh, at the end of the day, I can say, I have been fully living, fully alive. Because we're only granted moment by moment. And it's only in the presence that my higher power is with me. Not in the past, not in the future. It's now. And so these doggone Mondays, you know, that I dreaded, by gosh, now they're an adventure. They're still all mixed up, but they're an adventure. Monday's just as good as Saturday now, because if that's the day, or this is Friday, is it? Or Saturday? This is Saturday, isn't it? Well, anyway, you know, it's just as good. This is the only time I have. This is the only moment. And so I don't know if I'm going to be here at the end of this talk. I hope so. But and so that's what I've got to do. And so this kid, you know, as I mentioned, I didn't know where I belonged. But I had learned something. I had learned, number one, that God loved me, in spite of what I did and didn't do. And two, that when I was my sickest, when I was in greatest need, He was there for me. And by gosh, if the greatest force in all this universe can be there for me when I'm at my worst, when I'm sickest, I gotta have some worth. And that's just a gift. That's a gift from Him. And my self-worth being dependent on what I accomplish is for the birds, you know. And anybody who thinks that their worth, their self-esteem is dependent on their accomplishments, you're wrong. You are doomed to failure, because every time you do something, the next thing has to be greater. And what happens when you get the Nobel Peace Prize, or you get the Olympic gold medal? What do you do for an encore? You failed. You see, that is not the way to do it. This is a gift. Your self-worth is a gift from your higher power. And that's where it is, and you ask for it. That's what you do for a gift. You ask for it. And Well, and then the other thing, you know, the problems, that was a big problem for me. You know, I'd get into trouble and I pick myself up and I'd start going again and I'd be knocked down again, you know, and I thought, my gosh, God, you know, I'm really trying to do what you I think you want me to do. I bring my paycheck home, I keep a roof over my kids' head, and I try to be a good husband. At least I don't run out on her. I go to church, and what more do you want of me? And I'd be knocked down again, and finally I was knocked down to my knees. But what better position to be in to show some humility? And sure enough, I said, God, I can't do anymore. I've done everything I can think of, and I've really tried, and I can't do anymore. Would you please help me? And just like that, you know, just with that little effort on my part, my gosh, he flooded my heart with love. And you know what happens when your heart's full of love? Why, my gosh, you got to give it away, don't you? When something marvelous is happening, you got to give it away. And so here, I tried to give it to you people who had done so much for me, and I tried this time not to get you to be indebted to me. No, this time I did it just because I wanted to do something for you. And with this change of attitude, with this different approach, I finally realized I belonged. I belong to Al-Anon, and I belong to the human race. And now, let me just take a moment to tell you, or to try and tell you, what my higher power, what God has done for me. You know, he has given me his love through you, his messengers, both AA and Al-Anoners. You have given me enough love so that I could risk looking at myself and therefore work the program and grow. And this guy who didn't think he had any worth, who didn't like himself, this fellow who lived between a veil of tears and a black cloud over his head, whose life was negative, my approach to life was negative, I now had gratitude. My gosh, I had gratitude. And you know what gratitude is? Well, the definition is thankfulness, but that isn't the real definition. That isn't the only thing. Gratitude has thankfulness, all right. But secondly, it is a great gift. It's realizing that you've received a great gift that's completely unearned. And thirdly, there's this sense of obligation to pay in kind, pay back in kind. And that's what gratitude, and now I had this, you know. And you know, when you have gratitude, you can't be negative. You can't have both at the same time. And so now I had joy. And joy is a single most infallible sign of God's presence. And now I knew a new freedom, a new happiness, and we will comprehend serenity and know peace. Do you think these promises extravagant? We think not, but for they are being fulfilled amongst us, sometimes slowly, sometimes rapidly, but they will always materialize if we are willing to work for them. And I'd like to close with this quote. Life is a gift we are granted moment by moment. Let us be awed by the wonder of it, and then let us revel in it. I love you. Thank you for hearing me out.